Good evening. This is Milton Rosenberg. Welcome again to Extension 720.
Good evening. This is Milton Rosenberg. We welcome you again to Extension 720.
Good evening. This is Milton Rosenberg. Welcome again to Extension 720. Hello to all. This is Milton Rosenberg.
We'll talk about that tonight on Extension 720.
Into Extension 720 here on 720 WGN. I'm your host, Justin Kaufman. What a beautiful night for radio here in the Chicago area. This is our seventh episode of Extension 720. We're naming it Playing Games. That phrase can apply to a lot of different issues and conversations, like perhaps the best game in town, politics. Much has been made about our new mayor, but for all the focus on the Chicago election, our governor is talking about a progressive income tax that would force the state to crack open the Constitution. Is this a good thing? And while it's open, aren't there other things we should fix? David Rising from the Better Government Association joins us. Or what can you do when your community feels like it's getting played? This is at the heart of a new study put out about profiling in Chicago's Arab American communities. What was supposed to be a homeland security program to prevent domestic terrorism has some in those communities wondering if it's just a way for law enforcement to engage in illegal surveillance. We'll talk about that. Roderick Alamania is a big wig when it comes to the tech world, to media startups. He's been involved in some massive companies, but he's betting on his latest to be the business that breaks esports into the mainstream. We talk about the future of sports, which, like most everything else, looks to be digital. And grab a board game from the shelves at the Pullman Cafe. We continue our neighborhood tours tonight. We head to the historic Southside neighborhood to talk all things Pullman, a history lesson from an area that lived it and continues to live it firsthand. And since we are talking about playing game, let's talk hoops. The Bulls season wraps up this week, and after yet another rebuilding year, are they in any other better position than they were at the beginning of the season? National sports reporter Brandon Scoop B. Robinson is in town for tonight's game, and he'll stop by later. All that, plus more, tonight, Extension 720. But first, this weekend, I went out west to visit my friend, a Chicago guy who went from Columbia College classmate to roommate to best man in my wedding. He served in Iraq. He works with vets. He continues to give back. But he's going through something very, very tragic. His wife died. She had ovarian cancer, and after a long bout with chemo, she went into hospice and passed away last week. So me and a couple friends made the trip this weekend to console and support. We're guys, so there was a little bit of trepidation and anxiety about dealing with so much raw emotion. But once we were there, that melted away. We offered condolences and hugs and offered all the support. We asked what he wanted to do this weekend. He told us, play softball. One thing that's a constant in my friend's life is the softball league. He plays on a team of stringers. They're free agents. They don't have a team to call their own, so they made an extra. So random strangers play together each week, not really knowing much about who their teammates are or what they might be going through. My buddy's been playing on this team for quite a while now. His wife insisted on it. So when we were told that this softball game was that night, and it was a doubleheader, and he had shoes to fit, we had no choice.
Yes! Yeah! Go, go, go!
Let's go!
Nice hit!
The game was 12-inch glove. If you know me, I'm a 16-inch through and through, but when not in Chicago, you can't argue with the style of play. So we ran around the field trying to make plays and prove to the younger players that we still got it. Then the magic happened. A late-inning comeback, a full-on late-inning, extra-inning comeback. And my friend was at the center of it. A double to drive in the tying run. And after taking base, third base on the next play, he was 90 feet from winning.
Right. Come on, buddy.
Your mom, Sam.
All right, this is for Tommy.
Let's go, Sam.
Go, 2-3.
Come on, Tommy.
Yeah! Yeah!
Woo!
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 Woo! Let's go.
There you go.
We mobbed my friend at home plate. Typical walk-off behavior. And for the next 3 hours, we relived that memory from the game. Smiles on our faces, glory in our hearts. And we know it was just a game. We're well aware of that. This episode tonight is about playing games. For this random night under the lights, it was more than a game. It was a distraction. There was joy in Mudville, even for a minute. Stories of playing games, getting played, and playing sports. Tonight on Extension 720. Stay with us. It is Extension 720 here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Well, this is a game, or this is an episode we are calling Playing Games. And is there any game that's better in Chicago and the state of Illinois than politics? Much of our attention has been on the race for Chicago mayor, as it should have been, but the election is over, so it's time to turn our attention to the State House. There's a lot going on right now when it comes to changing the way we do taxes in this state, and it looks like the governor's moving ahead with his plan for a progressive tax plan, I guess you would call it. But to do so, he has to open the state constitution, and if he does, is there anything else he might be able to handle? I don't know. Maybe pensions? David Greising from BGA on the line with you. David, thanks for being here, bud.
Hello, Justin. Glad to be with you.
So this is, you wrote about this, that, I mean, let's first set the stage here for when we talk about a change in the tax, in the way we're taxed. That's really what we're talking about here, from a flat tax to a progressive tax. What does that mean?
Well, from a flat tax today, where everybody in the state pays the same rate, Governor Pritzker is pushing an amendment to the Constitution that would allow for a graduated tax. And the idea here is to tax the wealthy at a higher rate than individuals are taxed at. And he claims that 97% of taxpayers in the state would see their taxes actually go down. The top 3% would see their taxes go up, and some of them would see their taxes go up quite substantially.
Right.
People earning $1 million or more would pay 7.95% of their total income in taxes. That's about 3 percentage points higher than they pay, more than 3 percentage points higher than they pay now.
So why not just change this? Why talk about the process that you have to go through to change from a flat tax to a progressive tax?
Well, the Constitution requires a flat tax, and so in order to change this, you have to amend the Constitution, which is not easy. You have to get a 3/5 vote in both houses of the state legislature. Then you need a 60% vote of the on a ballot measure next time we, as voters, all go to the polls. And in order to do that, you have to do it in time to do it 6 months ahead of the next election. So he's got plenty of time to do it. He's got 3/5 vote. He's got super majorities in both houses of the legislature. So the only question on this progressive tax right now really is, will voters line up 60% in favor of this plan?
Right.
And that's why Governor Pritzker is on TV running commercials, trying to build support for this idea.
This is something that we have talked about a lot when it comes to the other big issue, which is pensions, this idea of cracking open the Constitution. It always falls flat because so many people will say, you know, that's the worst thing you could possibly do, to start messing with the framework of our government. But in this case, this doesn't seem to be that difficult with the numbers you're talking about. Obviously, it's still hard, but I mean, it seems like this is almost becoming an okay thing to do.
Well, that an argument I made in a column I wrote for Cranes this week is that as long as you're at it, if you're opening up the Constitution, you ought to look at some of the other huge issues facing the state, and in particular, the pension crisis that the state has. Illinois owes $134 billion in unpaid pension obligations, and there is no reasonable plan for addressing this huge problem. It's one of the state's biggest fiscal problems. Right now, the Constitution prohibits any changes to pensions. There's a language about diminishing or impairing pensions mm-hmm. once they're granted. So whatever the pension deal is, your first day of work for your state agency, that's the pension you get when you retire and beyond retirement. So some people think a constitutional amendment would enable the state to have more flexibility in trying to fix the pension problem. I agree with
yeah.
that point of view, and that's why I said they should look at changing the Constitution on pensions as long as they're changing it on taxes.
Is that something that they would have to announce ahead of time, David, say, hey, like, we want to take on pensions. While we're in here with the state's Constitution about the progressive tax plan, we want to change pensions as well. Or is it something, once it's open, they say, you know, I had another idea, and kind of pull the wool over everybody's eyes?
No, it doesn't really work that way. It would be interesting if it would, but it works as you have to pass actual language that would change the language in the Constitution. The reason that this idea of once you crack it open, make another change might make sense is that a progressive tax is very popular with Democratic voters and will almost certainly pass if it goes to a vote. A change in pension in the pension language is very popular with more conservative voters, Republican voters.
Right.
And this is a way for Governor Pritzker to show some bipartisanship in the way he governs the state. Just because you change the state constitution's pension language doesn't mean people's pensions are taken away by any means. It does not.
Yeah,
what it does is it gives the state some flexibility in trying to solve the problem.
Yeah, but you know as from covering business in this town that Governor Pritzker ran with heavy support from the unions in Springfield. Their rallying cries, don't you dare touch the state constitution. So how does he be able to placate and be bipartisan to the right and not anger the people who got him there on the left?
Well, for one thing, in your first year after you're elected, that's the time to make tough choices and do tough things with you, because you then have 3 years in which to recover politically. There's no doubt that the people, the labor unions that backed him for election, would very much disagree with this move. On the other hand, he's got so much in his legislative agenda that is favorable to them that this one issue alone, which really affects only several, you know, less than 100,000 voters in the state directly. I'm sorry, I might be wrong on that number, but believe me, the proportion of people who are actually directly affected by this is far lower than the number of people who don't have state pensions and who pay the bill for these huge pension benefits people get. So it's possible that in 3 years' time, he could recover politically. His liberal supporters, the unions included, will get enough out of him that they ought to be satisfied on balance with what Pritzker is doing in this state. There could be a political calculus by which it would make sense for him to do that.
One last question before I let you go, and we got a lot of static on your phone, so stop running around or jumping around, whatever you're doing, David.
Sorry about that.
That's okay. It's okay. This episode is about playing games, and one of the big issues, of course, in the state is about the casino. We have seen video gaming expansion on the table, and we've also heard everybody who's running, from Chicago mayor to small township district supervisor, talk about the need for another casino. Do you think that this is viable, that we're going to see a Chicago casino in the next 4 years? And is there a way that it's going to balance with this expansion of gaming in other places?
I think it is altogether likely that there would be a casino in Chicago in 4 years. The state needs the revenue that you can get from a new casino. The mayor of Chicago is foursquare. Lori Lightfoot has said she supports the idea of a casino. There's not that much opposition to gambling anymore the way there used to be. You know, Governor Pritzker said he's in favor of sports gambling. The restrictions against and resentment against gambling has decreased over time. So I would not be surprised to see that happen at all. Whether it happens this session or not, I don't know. They've got a pretty full docket heading into the end of the spring term at the end of May. But I wouldn't be surprised to see it happen during Governor Pritzker's first term.
David, you and I both know that the opposition was always seemed to spring from the suburbs and the surrounding areas that really took a lot of the revenue from their casinos. Is that not in play anymore? Is that a lost cause for the people who own the other casinos that are in earshot of what would be a downtown Chicago casino?
That sort of opposition will be there, but again, if you have support for that among the Democrats and the some of the places that you're talking about are more Republican leaning than Democratic leaning, if you have support for that among the Democrats, especially the Chicago caucus, House Speaker Mike Madigan and John Cullerton, both are from Chicago. Chicago interests often kind of dominate the legislature, mm-hmm. so it wouldn't be surprising at all to see it happen. You're right, there will be opposition, but there will be ways, they'll find ways to give more gambling sites, give them something in sports gambling or something.
Right.
There will be trades to be made that will perhaps eliminate some of this opposition that springs up elsewhere.
It'll be the heaviest bill in Springfield history. It's going to be loaded
up. It's going to be an amazing spring session. At the end of this session, there are going to be some really big legislative changes happening. It's really quite a fascinating first go-around for Governor Pritzker.
Well, looking forward to talking to you about that. President of the BGA, David Greising, joining us. David, thanks for joining us. Take some time out tonight.
Thank you, Justin. Sorry about the static. Oh, I switched off that headset, so I hope it's better now.
It sounds great. You sound great. Crystal
okay.
clear.
Thanks, thank you. Buddy. All right.
There you go, David Greising. Very interesting. Now, he said it, and you heard it, Andrea, that this is going to be one of the more spectacular spring sessions in Springfield when it comes to legislation. You'll be very hard-pressed to find no news around Springfield
know,
in the next
right?
couple months.
God, we
right?
had the, we had that budget impasse for the past
right.
4 years.
I wonder if I wonder how fast they'll move on the revenue side, and that's the gaming bill, and that's also the expansion of the casino, but it's also marijuana. So it'll be interesting to see how fast they move, and if they try to get all this stuff packaged up, and we get a new bill a minute coming up in the next month.
Yeah, because
it's over, right?
It's over
May. I think it was Memorial Day, Pete. That's when
May. Yep.
At the end of the spring session, so it's not really that far off. So you're going to get in the next 6 weeks. Some pretty fast moving legislation down in Springfield. We'll look forward to that, right? All right, coming up, we'll continue our conversation as we're playing games tonight. What happens when you feel like your community's being played? Welcome back to Extension 720 here on WGN Radio. I'm Justin Kaufman. Well, a new report out shines a light on a particular government program you might not be familiar with. But the CVE program is very well known to Muslim and Arab youth in Illinois. The CVE is an Illinois program that is funded by the Department of Homeland Security, and its job is to help communities and law enforcement officials recognize the signs of radicalization and domestic terrorism. But according to the authors of this report, the CVE, which is short for Curbing Violent Extremism, is doing less to foster community and more to undermine it. Tonight we talk about domestic terrorism and the tools that our government is using or misusing to fight it. In studio, one of the authors of the report, Debbie Southorn. She's a program associate at the American Friends Service Committee in Chicago. And Mohammed Sankari, who is with the Arab American Action Network. Mohammed, Debbie, thanks for being here.
Thanks so much for having us.
First of all, the report is called Suspected and Surveilled. A report on countering violent extremism in Chicago. Why this report?
The report came about after a couple of years of community organizing and sort of awareness raising around the ways CVE programs are rolling out in Illinois and how they're impacting Arab and Muslim communities in particular. And for a number of years, actually, Nicole Nguyen, the lead author of this report, had been doing FOIAs and Freedom of Information Act requests to just find out what these programs even are.
Right.
How is this happening? Because we know it exists, but we don't know who they're partnering with locally. We don't know how the money is being used. And so we've just been collecting a lot of this data for a long, long time. And we were finally like, you know what? The public has a right to know about this.
In the report, you talk about the origins of where this comes from. And it came from the Obama administration 2014, which was almost a remarketing or a softer approach to fighting violent extremism in American communities. This is something that seems on the front that like a good idea to partner with community groups. But as you point out in this report, it's just being used from law enforcement officials to surveil.
Yeah, so, you know, it comes in a line, like a long history of these kinds of programs that we've seen in the United States that use the guise of counterterrorism to really ramp up surveillance and racial profiling, predominantly of Arab and Muslim communities, and then oftentimes these tools are actually then kind of rolled out in other ways. Really, for us at the Arab American Action Network, we're super clear that CVEs, they just don't work.
On paper, the idea is that partnering with the communities mm-hmm. so that communities will better understand when one of their members is radicalized. That's the concept, right, behind CVE and why the Department of Homeland Security is funding these.
I mean, I think that the first problem is, what does that mean? And what are the signs of radicalization? And both of those questions still are unanswered. And in the report, you know, Debbie and Nicole did a really great job in breaking down why the premise itself is problematic. And social scientists agree across the board, including ones who work on CVE. There's no such thing as a marker of radicalization. There's no way you can look at me and Debbie and say, based on these 10 criteria, Debbie is more likely to become a violent extremist, or Muhammad is more likely, or whoever, right? Not race, not class, not... And these, you know, used to be ideas, right? Of like, if someone is poor and distraught and whatever, they're more susceptible to violent extremism. that's not actually the case.
Well, Debbie, you do a tremendous job in this report of breaking down some of the different departments, not just here in Illinois, but around the country, that have put together some of these warning signs. And they are so vague.
Right.
And on purpose, I would assume.
Right.
But they're vague that it does make you scratch your head, because it could be as simple as growing facial hair or
exactly.
Not sure what you're going to do next with your life is one. You know, like this idea that there are, they really do keep these vague. But these are the points they look to when they look to who's being radicalized.
Right, they're vague, but they have religious and political markers to them, right? So when you were saying there's no difference between us, I was giggling because I'm like, actually, you have a beard. And according to the FBI right. and a number of other frameworks that have been put out, that is an indicator of radicalization,
right?
So I think the first piece of this is really just debunking the idea that there is some kind of pathway, or that there are like clear indicators that can tell us for certain someone's going to become an extremist. And then with that, that also sort of erases the political landscape that we live in and what other factors drive the decisions people do mm-hmm. have around radicalization, for example. And it erases sort of inequality. And actually, if anything, further criminalizes dissent, right? It says if you're unhappy with how things are, that could be an indicator.
That's what I mean. The vagueness mm-hmm. where you look at the indicators of who could be a violent extremist or who could be radicalized, they are pointed at youth.
Right.
Like anyone
exactly.
who's young,
yep.
you know, just the idea of what you're going to do.
Exactly.
You're not sure. Maybe
not
you don't.
Sure.
You want change. You want to get involved in your community.
Mm-hmm.
To other things as well, which seem to be much larger. And when you talk about profiling and you talk about discrimination or just stereotypes,
right.
Growing beards, entering places of religious gatherings, things like that
right.
seem to point to one religion over another.
Definitely. I mean, I think that's exactly spot on. And that's why we've been so adamant in our organizing against it, is these undertones of the national program is really just like people from the Middle East, East Africa, South Asia that are of Muslim faith, right? That's generally what like the undertone without saying it has been and continues to be. So I think that it's exactly spot on, yeah.
Well, and I think the other key piece of this, right, is then what does the sort of community engagement aspect mean? On the surface, community partnerships, that sounds like a lovely thing. But when you really peel this back, it's actually really concerning to think that in order to access like more social service funding, or in order to access resources, right, community groups or mental health professionals or even teachers, right, are being encouraged to report people to law enforcement.
Right.
Here's resources with this important string attached, but we're going to de-emphasize that string.
Right.
And what it's leading to is more and more contact with law enforcement for communities that are already experiencing marginalization.
And this is not specific to Illinois as well. There are community
right.
organizers all over the country that are dealing with the Department of Homeland Security's CV programs, whatever state you're in,
right.
because of the fact that it seems more often that there is pushback from those community partners and others who say, this is discriminatory, you're just using me, or you're using the CV to surveil our communities.
Exactly. And we've been in partnership with people around the country.
Exactly.
So folks in Minneapolis, actually an amazing group of young Somali activists, have been calling out the ways that CVE funding and programs have really led to some really harmful consequences in their community. Some folks in LA actually managed to get LA County supervisors to reject a CVE grant, which was huge.
Right.
So this is happening nationally. And part of why this report felt so important is because the sort of elusive nature of these programs, right? They all have different names that sound like great mm-hmm. things. Targeted violence prevention, how wonderful. Or because of that, people don't know that it's going on. So we just really wanted to spotlight how this is happening here. And frankly, because of the pushback in other states, they're constantly trying to repackage and rebrand. And right now what's happening in Illinois is kind of the front end of that rebranding.
The report is called Suspected and Surveilled, a report on countering violent extremism in Chicago. One of the co-authors of the report, Debbie Southorn, is in the studio. She's a program associate at American Friends Service Committee in Chicago. Also, Mohammed Sankari is here. He's with the Arab American Action Network. We'll take a quick break. We'll come back and continue the conversation here on Extension 720. Stay with us.
Welcome back to Extension 720 here on WGN Radio. I am Justin Kaufman. In studio, we're talking about the new report that's out called Suspected and Surveilled, a report on countering violent extremism in Chicago. And the report is co-authored by Debbie Southorn. She's here. She's a program associate at the American Friends Service Committee here in Chicago. And Mohammed Sankari is with the Arab American Action Network. It is interesting because, as you mentioned, Mohammed, this comes from a long line of these kind of programs. And we were just discussing right before we went to the break. And one of the things I thought about was the FBI has had a troubled history with entrapment. And we saw this in Chicago where they'll say they caught a terrorist before they did it. But the reality is when you step back, you see a long system of persuading that person to radicalize, trying to find a youth to go along with a plan that might have not even been their plan, but exactly. It's something that the FBI. So this there is a long history to the way law enforcement has used some of these tools with communities of color and the Arab and Muslim communities.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think that that's an observation that unfortunately a lot of people don't know more about is when we start to unpack a lot of these quote-unquote foiled terrorist attacks in the United States, like the ones in Chicago, the young man who's still in the going through the court system right now, Adib Dawood, where it was a FBI agent who had provided him the ideology and then the tools and the money and the means and the target and the fake weapons and had just spent 2 years essentially mentoring him in incorrect ideas and in dangerous ideas to push him to a point in which he was willing to act on violence. You know, that's one extreme. We also have programs, mass surveillance programs that have been rolled out after 9/11 or the registry programs that were rolled out after 9/11. So again, you know, it's coming in this long history. And because of that, I think that the base of the community, as we say, like the average person, is so against these programs and so distrustful of what these programs might look like.
Debbie, that's part of the reason you guys put out the report, right? Because as you mentioned, they changed the name of these programs, or in the Obama administration, seemed to go out of their way to market it differently, to make it more of a community relations program as opposed to an anti-terrorism program.
Absolutely. And I think another iteration of that we're seeing now is the ways that CVE in just the past year and a half, 2 years, has been sort of expanded to be confronting white extremism, right? White supremacist extremism. Right. And while on the surface, that might sound great, right? White supremacy is awful. We don't want white extremists, right?
Right.
In practice, what has happened as a result of expanding CVE to supposedly include targeting potential white supremacists is that it's just providing legitimacy to a program that continues to overwhelmingly target Muslim communities.
Now,
and again, is based on some flawed science. And that's, so it's
and,
not actually
and I want to get back to the flawed science, but there is something that law enforcement officials will point to the fact that it works. They'll say that maybe they're taking away the rights of some, but it's for the good of all. And you hear this over and over. You see it with Stop and Frisk was a big thing when it came to police offices around the world using Stop and Frisk, but here in America. But there seems to be this logic, especially after 9/11, that you know some will lose their rights for the good of all. Is that what CVE is?
Yeah, the kind of the age-old safety versus civil liberties kind of debate that we're always pinned into. And my response is that it actually doesn't work. There's no data that can show us that when these programs that mass surveil or push entrapment or hype up policing of specific communities just do not work. When you pump tons of resources into finding a problem, you bet you're going to find that problem. But objectively, as you said before, when you take a step back and analyze this kind of rationally and objectively, you say we're not actually doing anything. We're not actually winning anything or preventing anything.
When you talk about the flawed science, and this is important because what happens is it feels like the indicators or the scientific rationale saying we have figured out that this is what's going to lead people to radicalization. Well, the problem at the end of the day is who is identifying that? Who's putting those things together? And that's in the science community, and you mentioned social scientists around the country and the world will say that's not accurate. But it still becomes logic. It still becomes the thing that is the backbone for the law enforcement officials around this country. So who is making those lists and why are we sticking to them?
In Illinois, right, I think one of the people who's been really, really pushing the science behind and the sort of theories behind this program is a researcher at UIC named Stephen Wine, who's taken Department of Homeland Security grants in order to create the social science that'll justify these programs. I think the goal, right, is that actually then community members will be the ones who will be doing the identifying. That's mm-hmm. the goal of CVE, right? Is that it won't be law enforcement.
Right.
That this is an alternative to law enforcement. If we give you these tools...
See something, say something.
Exactly.
Right. Right.
But again, we don't have evidence that it's worked. We have overwhelming evidence that actually it's just furthered harms in the community. And then I think the other piece of this, when we're talking about sort of like stopping white supremacy in CVE, is that one of the groups that was going to take a CVE grant, actually based out of here in Chicago, called Life After Hate, for years they'd been doing de-radicalization work with people who self-identified. So I've, you know, someone comes to them saying, I've been
right.
a part of a neo-Nazi group and
right,
I want
right.
help getting out. There's some validity to having a group to help people get out of that. The problem now is the ways that with CVE, they're trying to say, oh, we're instead of letting people self-identify, we're
going
to try to... We're going to try to use the internet and your search engine tools and also sort of these other nebulous things. We're going to take hundreds and hundreds of thousands yeah. of dollars to maybe identify you and then be able to stop you.
It's so interesting because these are the same themes that are playing out in other crime fighting areas right now. You mm-hmm. see a gang database in Chicago is one. We see a predictive technology that yeah. says where the next shooting might be. But a lot of the critics, we had Cory Doctorow was in here last week talking about you can tell technology to do whatever you want it to do. You can,
exactly.
you can use stats, but if the premise is false to begin with, all of it is false. And there seems to be similarities in this case.
Yeah, and I think that a very important question you asked is the why. If we can point to a bunch of educated people who do research that say, y'all, this isn't working, this is not how this works, why is this prevalent, or why do these ideas prevail and these markers still exist, I think it's because it fits dominant political narratives that we have right now, and it furthers political goals. In the case of CVE, it's the goal of U.S. foreign policy, right? Of we have a war on terror, we have enemies, and we need to maintain our foreign policy. Because if we don't fight them there, we're going to have to fight them here.
Yeah, but they also will make the argument saying that this is protecting the United States of America because there are people who do want to do harm to it.
And again, I think that fits in, right?
Right.
And same with predictive policing. If we feed enough data into a system that says more shootings happen on the west side of Chicago, you bet that algorithm is going to spit out that the next shooting is going to happen on the west side of Chicago. But it's missing all of the context to it.
You know, there's the overwhelming thought here as well is discrimination among Arab and Muslim American communities.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't get talked about as much as discrimination in some others. Why is that? Because it seems to me that the relationship between law enforcement and the Muslim and Arab American communities is as divisive or as fraught as others, the African American community, the Latino
right.
community. So why do you think it is that we don't hear more stories of profiling or more stories of police misconduct when it comes to these communities?
I think the first, you know, it's always good to take responsibility first. And I think that our community and our community institutions can do and should do a better job of elevating these stories. And I think that because of this national security versus civil liberties box, community leaders oftentimes shy away of saying, well, we want to talk about this as well. And then I think that the other piece is that, again, you know, there is a important political context that it's happening in with U.S. foreign policy and U.S. domestic policy. And so the FBI, with their entrapment cases, fulfills both ends of that in terms of fulfilling domestic policy of showing that, like, we're doing something and it's working.
Mm-hmm.
And then the foreign policy goals of what do we want to do in the Middle East and why is it important that we keep up the fight there so we don't fight it here.
And Debbie, back to the report as we wrap up. As you set out what the problems are with CVE, what's the fix? Is the fix to work on a different set of facts that start the premise of a CVE, or is it to scrap CVE entirely? What's if we all can agree that curbing violent extremism is important, what is the fix?
I think the problems with frameworks like CVE is they assume that law enforcement is going to be the fix. They assume that that the answer to violence is always more policing and more enforcement. I think similarly, like in Chicago, there's questions around like, how do we end violence in the streets, or how do we engage violence, right? You were mentioning predictive policing. There's so much money being poured into that right now. Can you imagine how different things would look if we poured the same kind of resources into after school programs, jobs for young people, into real economic development that meant communities have what they need in order to thrive? I think similarly, when we talk about violent extremism, if we erase the larger political landscape of empire, right, of extreme political imbalance, of who's in power and who is not in this country and around the world, we're doing ourselves a real disservice because we're erasing sort of root causes. So I think in a really big way, what we say is the answer is actually resources for communities that are marginalized. And part of that, too, is more access to mental health resources. We know one of the groups that the law enforcement is constantly trying to target for entrapment, for surveillance, and even in Illinois, they are targeting mental health professionals to keep an eye out for mentally ill individuals. We need resources for people, not to set people up to fail, which is exactly what the paradigm of CVE and of surveillance and enforcement in general have been doing.
The report is called Suspected and Surveilled, a report on countering violent extremism in Chicago. One of the co-authors of the report, Debbie Southorn, is here. She is a program associate at American Friends Service Committee in Chicago. And Mohammed Sankari is with the Arab American Action Network. Thank you so much for coming in tonight. I appreciate it.
Thanks so much for having us.
Welcome back to Extension 720 here on WGN Radio. I'm Justin Kaufman. Well, my guest in studio with me is one of the rising stars in the business of esports. Esports is a fancy word for gaming, which is a fancier word for video games. But please put away your preconceived notions or stereotypes of what you think of video games, because the budding business is raking in millions. Roderick Alemania is a serial entrepreneur in media startups. He was part of IGN Entertainment that was sold to News Corp for $650 million back in 2005. But recently, Alemania has turned his attention to the esports world. He's partnered with some of the legends in gaming to create Ready Up. Ready Up is a platform that connects gamers at all levels of play. Alemania and Ready Up are betting big on esports. This past fall, they raised $2 million in capital. Tonight, a conversation about the future of sports. Esports. Roderick Alemania is in town for the IEG World Conference. He's my guest in studio. Roderick, thanks for being here.
Hey, thanks for having me.
First of all, you were at the IEG conference, and all of it was about transforming the world. I think that the thread was blurred.
Correct.
You spoke at the conference. What did you tell people?
Yeah, well, we were talking about partnerships and experiences. One of the things that we're doing at Ready Up is we've partnered with the NBA Players Association. And one of the experiences that we're in the process of executing shortly is for fans to be able to engage some of the top NBA stars who are huge gamers and essentially connect with them through gaming.
I can't even believe that would be it. I just flash back to me being 15 years old and thinking I could play Glenn Rice. That's Glenn Rice. That's crazy. But that is the future, this opportunity to do all these different experiences with real people in a virtual world.
What was interesting about the process, we connected with the NBPA in, I think, July or August of last year, and we had a really great conversation with Michelle Roberts, who's the executive director. And one of her quotes was, "We realized gaming wasn't going to be the pet rock that it was here to stay." Interesting stat, 90% of the basketball players play video games.
Wow.
And a funny story she told us was she was out with some of the players one night, and after dinner, she was telling them, "Yeah, you guys, you know, go home, don't get into trouble." And she said, "What are you guys going to do?" And they said, "We're going to go do some Fortnite." And she said, "Where's that club located?"
You know, Fortnite, that's a good place to start.
Sure.
Because esports has been on the forefront of our culture for the last couple decades now. But Fortnite has brought it to a new level. You're starting to see it permeate culture in a way that it's, like you said, it's no longer the pet rock. It is the rock. Do you need games like Fortnite and experiences like that come along to get the business of esports into a higher level of visibility?
Yeah, you know, Fortnite was great for the industry on a couple levels. One of the interesting things about Fortnite was you actually saw a lot of girls and women playing it, but actually more girls, I'd say, at the high school level. You know, traditionally, video games has been focused on, you know, males, 18 to 34. You know, this was a really interesting crossover, at least in the kind of the more hardcore, what you consider more hardcore gaming side of the business. When you look at mobile games, they're obviously massively populated by women, games like Candy Crush and such. But this was, you know, a game changer.
Yeah. And what? Why? Why? What is it about Fortnite, if from your estimation, that made it so popular?
Well, you know, it was kind of the combination of Minecraft meets a game called PUBG, which was you know, the first kind of really popular battle royale that kind of became more mass market. The growth curve on both of these games was tremendous. I mean, literally zero to several tens of millions of users in a very short period of time. Perfect example, Fortnite, the next game that came along was one called Apex Legends, which is another battle royale published by EA. And I believe they went from like zero to almost 40 million in literally weeks as opposed to months.
Wow. It's amazing to think about the trajectory right now. And you, as someone who, reading your background, you got your start in starting media startups. So how do you get from there to esports?
I've been kind of working in startups since 1995. I was working at an ad agency on the media side. This is a really fun story. We had Microsoft as our account. And literally, I believe it was probably like 8 months before Windows 95 launched. Windows 95 launch was huge. They needed an online plan. Back then, online meant getting online through AOL or Prodigy or CompuServe, and no one really cared about it. And so it was, hey, give it to the young 20-something-year-olds who care about that stuff. We're dealing with TV and we're dealing with print. And we launched Windows 95 on the internet. I met InfoSeek, which was the first search engine to ever do putting ad banners with keywords, which Google obviously has since perfected.
That's the heart and soul of it now, right?
Yeah, and the crazy part was that InfoSeek actually recruited me, and I became the first sales hire there that wasn't an executive.
What did you learn about that experience that you keep with you several years later with ReadyUp?
You have to persevere when you're kind of on the cutting edge. I mean, literally, 468x60 ads were considered a crazy new ad unit, which is something that we're like thinking, whatever. You know, it took time. It didn't happen overnight. It took, God, probably 6 to 9 months, and you just had to persevere.
When you're working in startups and subsequent startups after that, and even the one ReadyUp, do you have to remind people around you who might be new to that business that it takes time, that it's not something that's an overnight flash in the pan, even if there is success?
Absolutely. It's hard.
You're the wise old man in the room. Right?
Thanks for calling me old man. It's one of those things where it doesn't happen overnight. And you get a lot of no's and it's a lot of education. After I left InfoSeek, I was fortunate enough, we got acquired by Disney. That was back in the internet heydays. When I worked at IGN Entertainment, IGN.com, we were kind of more hardcore gaming focused. We weren't doing a lot of ad revenue with the video game publishers who were spending all their money in print. Mm. So it was just a function of time and working my ass off. And suddenly, boom, it exploded. And, you know, the long story short was we took the company private at $26 million, and we ended up selling to News Corp for $650 million.
That's amazing. And for you to be a young entrepreneur, to be in a position where you're seeing that kind of money, what does it do to you? Because you're not getting the six. There's a lot that goes into getting $650 million. But the win to be a startup, an entrepreneur, the win on getting that sale had to have been huge.
You know, when I was at InfoSeek, we went public literally within probably, I don't even remember, a year or two after I'd been there. I mean, I'd gone from making $18,000 a year living in San Francisco, which is just ridiculous because I think I remember I'd go out and spend $40 a night and be like, oh, man, I'm done to, you know, working at a company that went public. And it's completely life changing. It's very life changing. And, you know, it's one of those things where, you know, it's probably a little bit arrogant when in your 20s when you come into that sort of success. You know, luckily, my wife, who I've been married to, 24 years now this year? Or I'm sorry, 19 years this year. We'll be 19 years
together,
this year.
Together, 24.
Yeah, sure. And, you know, she was the kind of person who kept me in check.
There you go. So, you always need that.
So there you go.
Roderick Alemany is my guest. He is one of the guys behind ReadyUp. You guys are betting big that this is the future of gaming, of esports, is organization. And we'll talk about that coming up here. More with Roderick and talking about esports here on Extension 720. Stay with us.
Welcome back to Extension 720 here on 720 WGN Radio. I'm Justin Kaufman. Roderick Alemania is in studio with me. He is one of the guys behind Ready Up, which is a new platform betting big on esports, and was just in town for the IEG World Conference that was at McCormick Place. Roderick, we're talking a lot about your successes because you're looking back at your CV and the successes that you've had in startups. You keep winning and winning and winning. When you approach a new project like Ready Up, do you have a lot of confidence because of your track record? Do you look and say, you know what, this is a slam dunk?
So I had gotten involved at esports back in 2006 when I was at IGN. Right after we got acquired by News Corp, DirecTV gave us a call and they said, hey, we're going to start covering video games the same way we cover Sunday Ticket. You know, long story short on that one was that we created three television shows, which then blossomed into this league that News Corp threw $45 million into, which is crazy, right? Unfortunately, we were trying, you know, there was no Twitch, there was no YouTube back then. Distribution was expensive. Production was expensive. I learned about TV production. I got a producer credit, which was kind of cool.
There you go.
ultimately, the league failed. And I took a hiatus from esports. And back in 2017, reconnected with a guy named Jonathan Wendell, his Gamer Takes Fatality. Jonathan and I had worked together at Championship Gaming
legend.
Series.
Yeah,
he's crazy good. 12-time world champion. He's still amazingly good, just inducted into the Esports Hall of Fame. So we were connected back in 2017. And, you know, my observation on esports was, hey, this has obviously grown tremendously in terms of audience and in terms of revenue, thanks to companies like Twitch and YouTube. It had grown, but it necessarily hadn't matured as an industry.
Yeah, that's a great point. And I think that's a great jumping off point for us to get into esports is that you will have successful industries that will attract huge audiences, especially new media. Yet the business side of it lags behind. The opportunities that might be there when it comes to partnerships, when it comes to sponsorships, when it comes to some of the things that you're seeing big industries like football or basketball take advantage of. You come along, you see that there is a missing link there, and you can fill that link. You could think about esports as an industry growing bigger, getting bigger because of business.
So it's interesting you brought up football and traditional sports. What we're doing at Ready Up isn't rocket science. It's literally taking best practices you see in traditional sports that have structure and organization. It's looking at other industries that have structure and organization and just applying it to a really nascent market that's global, that has, you know, the challenges that we're looking at in the U.S. are applicable globally. Mm-hmm. So literally what we're in the process of doing is just putting in the structure and organization that you find in other businesses into this really nascent market of esports.
You're right. It's a simple concept when you talk about Ready Up. And what I love it is that you have an anecdotal story about coaching soccer, coaching
yeah.
the league. Just
yeah.
this concept of when you were having to organize everybody, you recognized that there was a need.
Yeah. So there's an app called Team Snap. If you have kids, you live by it religiously. It tells you who's on your team, when's practice, who's showing up, all the things of logistics that aren't necessarily rocket science, but it's literally a pain in the ass to manage.
It's better than the phone tree.
Yeah,
phone
tree.
Right.
So when we were looking at the esports space, made that observation, God, there's all these teams globally, and you know, I bet you they're having the same issues around that.
Trying to organize everyone, when they're going to be there, who's playing who, that kind of stuff.
Exactly. So as we started to think about Ready Up, we spent 7 months really validating the idea with the market, from publishers to leagues to professional teams to amateur teams, to make sure that if we were going all in on this, there was a there. This wasn't something that we just said, hey, let's build.
Right.
We were really thoughtful about the process of pulling this company together. There's really kind of three pillars to the product. It's meet, compete, and get better. And think of meet as being LinkedIn meets Tinder for gaming.
Yep, yep.
Helping players find teams, teams find players at all levels of play.
Roderick, this is important because when I think of video games, and especially the advent of a newer generation, the backbone of video games and gaming is playing competition to be able to connect through the internet and play strangers.
Right.
There's a limit to that where you're constantly playing people you don't know. And really what people are doing is they're finding shortcuts to get online at the right time to play people they know.
Yeah.
And things like that. So this is the platform that helps bring those people together and organize them so they're playing their friends and playing people they know and competing against people that are at their level.
This is no different than traditional sports. Think about hoops. You play pickup hoops.
Mm-hmm.
And you just, obviously you love to play basketball, but you just don't go randomly and play with strangers. You find your crew, you find your tribe. And we're finding gaming is the 20-somethings that grew up with gaming. This is their version of pickup hoops in many ways. And what's different is you don't necessarily have to be physically next to that person to play. And, you know, a lot of times it's, I just want to find cool people to play with. A lot of my friends may not be playing this game. I want to find other people that are just as good as me or better, or maybe not as good as me, but they're just really cool people to hang out.
Yeah.
It's literally just socialization.
It's great, too, because what I like about it is that you incentivize people to get better. You incentivize people to compete and then to show how good they're getting. And their incentive, obviously, with blockchain and virtual currency is involved with this. But this concept, and you see this now as almost standard when it comes to gaming, that there are ways you get to a certain level and you're rewarded for it.
Yeah. So we address all levels of play. We've designed the product where it really needs to have deep features to appeal to gamers, but it also has to be simple enough to use where if I don't consider myself a gamer, but I like to play games,
right. It's
an easy enough to use environment. One of the areas we're trying to tackle in gaming right now is that, you know, gaming is very much, you're either in the cool folks or you're not. And part of what we're trying to do is grow the industry, because if it grows, all boats rise with the tide. And so if we're trying to make Ready Up this place where anyone who is either a gamer or enjoys to play the game, the product and the service adds value to it.
That's interesting. So there is a little bit of a have and have nots in the way that gamers approach video games. Meaning you're going to have some people who are in a clique, they're in the cool, this is the crew to be in, and everybody else is trying to get in there.
That's exactly right. And when you think about gaming, the gaming audience being a pyramid, you know, the hardcore, the pro, and the hyper-competitive, and then as the pyramid gets down to the bottom, it's more of the mass market folks. Mm-hmm. They may never want to play in a competition, but it might be, hey, I want to jump online on Thursday and do a raid or play some Apex or Fortnite or PUBG with my friends, just help my crew. That's where the mass opportunity is.
So you see that's where, and beyond Ready Up, do you see that's where gaming is going, where esports is going, where, and I'm not talking about competitive at the point where they're professional, but even the amateurs finding a way to organize their lives where gaming is an organized part of it.
When you think about how people are consuming gaming, I think it was Netflix said their biggest competitor is Fortnite, and it's in terms of engagement. You know, people enjoy playing video games where gamers and people who game spend a disproportionate amount of time and money gaming. And part of what we're doing with the product, which is, you know, I talked about Meet Compete, is all about that whole Team Snap model, scheduling. It's like, hey, I got my crew of people. Let's do a raid. Let's make sure that it gets put into our calendar. It could also be, since we're doing a calendaring system, it also could be, hey, I'm a huge fan of gaming. I don't necessarily play a lot, but maybe I'm a huge League of Legends fan. There's tons of events. There's tons of streams going on. But there's really nowhere to find that information. There's no, like, you know, going old school, there's no TV guide. Yeah. So what we're doing with that calendar, with the calendaring system, is we're also creating an events calendar. So if you're a fan, you can find out, hey, here's a game I like. Maybe it's Call of Duty. Click on it, and it tells you where everything's at. Yep.
Roderick Alemani is in studio with me. He's one of the guys behind Ready Up. We're talking esports tonight on Extension 720. And when we come back, I want to talk about the broader, there's some really interesting things when you talk about the business side when it comes to data, when it comes to time spent, and just how more and more this is becoming a business, more than just sort of friends getting together to play. There are business opportunities there. And I want to talk more about the future of esports. Roderick Alemani, my guest here on Extension 720. Stay with us. More with Roderick Alemania coming up here. Coming up at the 9 o'clock hour here in Extension 720. Lee Bay is going to take us on a tour of Pullman for our Chicago neighborhood tour. We're continuing. The Southside neighborhood is our latest spot. That's tonight at the Pullman Cafe at 112th and St. Lawrence. Pete, I think that's exactly where we were on the Southside today. And so Lee Bay is going to talk to us about the issues that are facing his community. Lee, of course, a longtime architecture critic and blogger, and he also has a book on Southside architecture. And man, the architecture rolling through Pullman, I was just blown away. And I've been to Pullman, I've been around it, but I have not spent the time that we spent, which was not a lot of time today. But going through there and looking at the row houses, I mentioned a couple shows back that Chicago architecture is similar everywhere you go, whether you're on the South Side, North Side, West Side. The style of Chicago architecture is one that, you know, connects us. Not so much in Pullman. That is an entirely different style. Those row houses, you don't see that. I don't think you see that. Maybe you see that in some of the old time, like Boston's or Baltimore's, things like that on the East Coast. But amazing architecture. We'll talk with Lee Bay about that coming up. And also, we're going to talk about the Bulls, who are playing the New York Knicks tonight. Huge implications. No, I kid, of course. We're talking about the Bulls. There are no implications. They are set where they're at. They failed in being the worst. They're going to be the fourth worst. We'll have that combo coming up in the 9 o'clock hour.
Welcome back to Extension 720 here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Roderick Alemani is in studio with me. He's one of the guys behind Ready Up, which is a new platform for esports that helps organize gamers from the amateurs to the professionals. It's getting a lot of buzz in the industry, and it's just raising capital this fall, raised $2 million. It was just here at the IEG World Conference that was at McCormick Place. It continues to get a lot of buzz. And this idea of esports, we've been talking about it, and we've been talking specifically about it, but people, if we pull back a little bit and we say, okay, this is an industry that for the last 10 years people have been saying, oh, this is the future. Gaming's the future. You see these stories pop up all the time. Now these young kids are making money off of, they're making six figures off of playing video games. But what makes today the day? What makes 2019 better than 2017 when it comes to gaming and this industry?
You know, literally it's a function of games like Fortnite bringing it into kind of mass market levels and mass market awareness. Perfect example. If you saw the NFL 100 commercial that they did, and it had all those Juju Smith-Schusters at the beginning of it, if you're a gamer, you'll realize the guy with the pink hair, that was Ninja. Ninja's in the...
Yeah, right.
That just goes to show that this is beginning to hit a mass market. Gaming, actually, it's a massive market. There's 2.3 billion people that play games globally. It's a massive multi-billion dollar industry.
I was listening to an interview you did, and you had a good point of talking about gaming being this generation's form of entertainment. You know, you and I, we may have grown
movies.
Up. We watched basketball, football, or even played it. That was our form of entertainment. But gaming has replaced, and still obviously mass media when it comes to those sports. But for a younger generation, gaming is the basketball, the baseball, the football.
That's exactly right. And to that point, when you look at what's going on in the esports space, there's a lot of ownership groups from basketball, football, and baseball getting in the esports. And I think it's twofold. First thing is, you know, they're trying to use this as a way to, video games as a way to maybe bring audience into their sport. When you look at the average age of NFL.
Like a crossover, yeah.
Yeah, it's 40s.
Right.
It's also a hedge for them. You know, the second thing is, not that those sports are going to die anytime soon, but if this is the new sport of this generation, they need to be there. And that's why you see so much investment coming from the professional sports.
There's a... I want to talk about two things before we wrap up this hour. One, I have an 11-year-old son, and every time I talk to any other parent, anywhere from 6 years old to 14, it's, he can't get his head out of the iPad. And the second is, he watches people play video games.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
That's
I have an 11-year-old, and he watches people every morning.
And everyone of our generation up goes, how is that even possible? How is that entertaining? Yet, he can't take his eye off it. And I look at the numbers from Twitch, from YouTube. I investigate the gamers that he's watching. They're getting millions and millions of clicks and monetizing those clicks. There is something there that we may not understand. You obviously do, being in the business, but that we may not understand as parents that is fundamentally different than our generation.
Sometimes I don't even understand it when I work in the business. But, you know, when we're talking to brands and talking to folks that are looking at the esports space, my comment is always, doesn't really matter what you think. This is what's happening. So you can either embrace it or you can just say, I don't get this and move on. And those who say, I don't get this and move on are going to be left out, especially on the marketing side. Yeah. This audience, it's a millennial audience that's doing this, hardest to reach audience in media. And like I said, it doesn't matter if you get it or not. This is what's happening. So you just need to embrace it and try to understand it.
I think the millennial generation gets a bad rap across the board. I'll hear across our station, other places, just funny stories about how millennials treat jobs or how they treat money or how they treat, you know, they love it. They love the jokes, right?
Yeah.
But there's something to be said that they're savvier than we ever were. And when you think about esports and gaming, and you've talked about this as well, I was thinking about marketing. They're very aware that people are using their data. They're very aware where you and I, or, you know, me,
yeah.
I'm like, oh, this is a free site, and I don't understand why, you know, like, oh, they're taking my data? How did they get my data? I'm acting like it's a complete LUD.
Yeah.
But what esports is doing is they recognize that they understand, and like places like ReadyUp saying, we know that we're using your data and using marketing to you specifically, and they expect it, and they want something from it.
I'm glad you're bringing up this topic. It's if you're a brand, this audience knows you're marketing to them. Don't interrupt their content experience. You know, that's what we've been doing. And I've been guilty of it, being a meeting executive. It's in the old school days, it's throw this ad up. See my brand. Click on this. Now, you know, the approach should be about add value. Add value could mean give me something that I would normally pay for.
Mm-hmm.
But it's essentially bring me something that I want instead of throwing something in front of my face.
And this is because a younger generation is got savvy to what marketers and advertising people were doing.
That's exactly right. In the mobile ad space, so I worked at a company called Tapjoy, which is one of those ad programs where if you choose a view advertising, you get virtual currency in the game, mobile game that you're playing.
Yeah, right, right.
So value exchange advertising, it's I chose to engage with ads, they leveraged my data, but now I'm getting something that I would have to pay for through, you know.
And I see this all the time, Roderick. I see it when my son is playing a video game on an iPad, and he'll say, I want to buy this character. And I'm like, well, I'm not giving you any money.
Yeah.
And he's like, no, it doesn't work that way. I watch an ad.
Yeah.
And it gives me currency.
Yeah.
It's just an interesting way to think about that. He knows that he's got to watch an ad to be able to succeed in the video game that he's playing. And that's something that my generation, I don't know if we would accept that.
This is an interesting point. So when you think about what's happening in media, think about what happened with Facebook with all the issues around data and consumers like, oh my God, they made so much money off of my data. What I think we're going to see happening, and we'll see this happen with ReadyUp down in the future, is the decentralization of media companies, where if I'm a consumer and I'm giving my data, give me something in return financially. Yeah. And even though it's got a bad rap, but I think, you know, cryptocurrency and tokenization is an interesting loyalty system for the gaming industry because gamers fundamentally understand virtual currency.
Could you see a world we live in where that virtual currency, because the way that it's always couched in any sort of news reports or mass media is that this blockchain that's going to replace cash, or it's going to be the new currency. Yeah, it never work. This is a flash in a pan kind of thing. But could it work in the environment you're talking about and be complementary to a monetary system that we have?
Absolutely. We actually have that in our plans. We were going to execute it last year, but things went south with the crypto market, so we decided to put it on hold. But I still fundamentally believe that there's a huge opportunity around creating, just basically taking a loyalty program and tokenizing it. And if you happen to choose to engage with an ad, there's an actual back-end transaction where the advertiser says, here's a buck for sending someone my way. And as a decentralized media company, what you can do is say, hey, user or consumer, here's X percent of that transaction because you drove value.
I was going to say, it feels no different than banks. Banks have done this with credit cards and other places where they'll give you cash, the cash back deals.
Yep.
It's not real cash. Like, I can't cash that out and use it for anything,
right. But
I can get 5 cents off of Starbucks. Or
whatever.
But it's the same concept.
Same concept, but it's with the cryptocurrency. Here's my whole thoughts on crypto and blockchain. We're two separate things, but we don't have enough time to go on that. Is that what happened in the crypto market? Same thing happened with the internet market when I was there. It had this tremendous growth, had a lot of Yahoos come in there, not Yahoo.com, but just
Yahoos.
Bad actors who kind of gave it a bad name. And I think, you know, over time, just like what happened with the internet, real companies will emerge.
I am a dad who, and this really grabbed my attention. So we have Nintendo Switch. And at one point or another, I did a luxury purchase where I got NBA 2K, right?
Yeah, nice.
Yeah, fun. It was a throwback to when I was in my 20s playing Sega Genesis or whatever it was, you know, playing Nintendo, playing NBA. And I play it and I have fun with it, you know, and my son, he says, you want to know what because the Switch will rank how much time has been spent on each game.
Yeah.
So he tells me, I like my Minecraft, it's this number. And he's like, Kirby is this number. You know, whatever it is up the line.
It's like social credibility.
Yeah, and then he goes, and the number one is NBA 2K. You've played it more than I have the entire... Like, I had no idea, because you play a 15, 20-minute game.
Yeah.
But he's like, the time spent on the device, I own it. The 44-year-old dad owns it. And I thought about that, and I was like, that is so interesting, because I grew up in video games, and I don't necessarily think about how much time I'm investing in it when I'm playing. When I'm playing it, I'm playing it. And I wonder how much, just like when you think about Netflix or you think about websites or anything else, that's so incredibly valuable to your industry, how much time these people spend on these video games.
Well, it equates to money now. The model now isn't necessarily, I'll sell you a $60 game, hopefully you'll buy it again. It's, I'll sell you a game or I'll give it to you for free, but then I'm going to put in-game virtual currencies
right,
in there,
right.
And I'm going to put items that you want to buy. And that's essentially what we're kind of focused on at ReadyUp, is all about feeding into the ecosystem. The more time spent people playing games, the different players in the video game industry win. Perfect example, publishers. The longer you play their game, assuming they have a virtual economy attached, that literally equals money.
So it's no longer waiting for the new game to come out in the Target and go buy it for $69.99 or whatever it is. The new version will be trying to have the in-app or in-game
absolutely.
Purchases.
It's a life. Games are a life service now. It's no longer a finished software product, ship, and go on to the next one. It's a live service. Like I said, the more you play, the more money that makes for the publishers.
It's amazing to me because, you know, I think about how much time, and, you know, sometimes I feel like I'm a bad parent, that, you know, you'll have the iPad or whatever it might be, or the Switch or whatever it is, and he's on it, and he's got his head in there, and I'm just like, he should go out, he should run around, he should, like I did, he should go throw twigs.
Yeah, you know, exactly.
But, you know, you feel there's this social pressure that I feel bad as a parent that he's got his hand, because you'll see all of them, from the medical community to, it doesn't matter, people tell you that it's bad for development.
Yeah.
But I grew up that way. And I'm the first generation that did, in the way that I'd sit downstairs in my basement playing RBI baseball on Nintendo or whatever it was.
Man, you're going old school, my brother.
But the point being that there was Atari and things like that. We were the generation that started video games.
Yeah.
And so I'm not sure that I buy into the societal warnings about too much.
Obviously, there's too much of a, you always have that balance, right? I think the biggest difference between them growing up now and versus us is that these games are social. At least that's what my son Jordan always says. Dad, I'm not playing games, I'm socializing. I'm like, I'm going to call BS on that. You're playing games, dude. But I like how you're trying to spin it. And he is, he's playing with his friends.
Yeah.
A perfect example, the other day when I came to Chicago, he hadn't come home. His grandmother's watching him. It's like, where the hell is he? Called a couple of his friends that he wasn't at their house. And then I get a text from him. Oh, yeah, he's over at so-and-so's house because I'm online playing games with him. So I guess he was socializing.
He was socializing. This is a fascinating topic, and I appreciate you giving your time. I know you're busy, and to come in and explain to us the future of esports. Roderick Alemania is one of the guys behind ReadyUp. ReadyUp is a platform. So if people are listening to this, what's the rollout? When do we go? How do I get ReadyUp?
Go to ReadyUp.com. Right now we are in private beta. You can sign up for the beta, and you can get in. We plan a full rollout in the June timeframe, right around the E3 show. So super excited about that. We're furiously building product right now. It's looking great, and we're really excited about this rollout.
Roderick, thanks so much for being my guest tonight. I appreciate it.
Thanks, man. Thanks for having me.
Let me read this from 847. It's really interesting. He says, it's really kind of sad. I have a 13-year-old daughter who's totally engrossed in this culture. I've tried to encourage her to ride her bike over to a friend's house to hang out like we did when we were kids. Instead, they play together online. She's on social media so much, and I have no idea how to get her to actually interact with people in person. If you have any advice about this, please share. I don't have a lot of advice. I do have a similar situation. I would assume a lot of our listeners with kids in the age of middle school to teenager also can help and can empathize with what you're saying. And I wonder, because I truly do think, Pete, and you and I are the same age, we are of a generation that
our parents were worried about us sitting in front of video game consoles, whether that was Nintendo or Sega or even our Atari.
Mm-hmm.
And there was all this, it was before thought pieces on the internet, so they couldn't share thought pieces. But there was all sorts of concern that we were missing out on fresh air, and kind of said in the interview, you know, throwing twigs down by the creek, whatever one does in Wonder Lake, Illinois. But yeah, I do agree with 847 in the sense that we were of the generation where it was a little bit of crossover, meaning we still did the ride bikes.
There's a balance there.
Yeah, we did have, and I'm sure it's revisionist history, because I'm sure if you asked parents, they would say, no, there wasn't balance. You guys spent most of the time in the basement playing Mario and listening to Nelson After the Rain.
Oh, my God, I had the biggest crush on Matthew and Gunner. Oh, don't start me on the Nelson twins.
I can't live without your love. Playing Zelda. Andre, were you a big video game person?
I was not. I had, so I was like Atari and Intellivision kind of before Sega and Nintendo.
Yeah.
And we had Intellivision, which I thought was fun
great.
And cool.
Yeah, right.
But 90% of the time we were outside playing. Just all the neighborhood kids played together. The boys, the girls. The athletes, the non-athletes, and my friend David Paletti had a wooden baseball bat, and we would play with a tennis ball, and we'd play baseball all, you know, in the summertime, all day, and then the streetlights would come on, you go home, and one time the bat cracked, and we're like, oh my God.
That's the worst.
You know, it's just like, you know, it's like the bat and the natural cracks, and, you know, you're looking at it like, oh, so we took duct tape, we taped it up, and we just start playing again.
That's great. I wonder. I have an 11-year-old son, and obviously he, I mentioned it a couple of times in this interview. I mean, he has got his head sewn to that iPad, or to the computer, and so many games in so many ways. And yeah, it is a constant struggle. Now, we live in the city, and it's a different time, and it's a different era where you can't just, when I grew up, and I'm sure it's similar to you, Andrea, where you would just get called home, or when it was dark, you just run home.
Yeah, you go home.
That's not a possibility. That's a different generation.
It is. It really is.
Even in some of the suburbs. I honestly had friends in the suburbs. Like, our kids don't go play out in somebody else's yard and we yell out for them to come home.
No, you just don't do it anymore.
Yeah. So I do. So it's finding that balance and trying to get, obviously physical activity is important, and being able to socialize with other people is important. But I also would say to 847, as a parent, what I'm recognizing from conversations with Roderick and others is that this is the new normal. And this is something for the last 10 years or so that you've seen more and more kids get into. And that's just and I know there were scary things that were part of our generation and even the generations before. I can't even think what parents thought of the Beatles. That kind of thing. So I do think it falls into that category, because I have a hard time, having my son spend his time watching somebody else play a video game, right? That's something that I feel like I have a hard time with.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure it's really that big of a deal. At the end of the day, it may just be a different form of entertainment than I am, right?
Like, you watching MASH reruns was any better?
Please tell me he's joking.
No, I never liked MASH, but he's right in the sense that that was what we did. We got home from school and we watched Heathcliff.
Oh, yeah, or like Tom and Jerry.
Yeah, Tom and Jerry and things like that. And that's not a thing. I mean, they have Cartoon Network, but it's not as
or the
routine.
Or the after-school movie.
Whatever happened to those?
Remember?
That would be... Now, if I could get him to watch somebody watching an after-school special, I'd feel much better about that. Well, you're right. The after-school specials are gone in the past.
The one where the kid had to wet his bed.
Yeah.
The mom put the sheets out the window.
And that same kid was in every one, Lance, something or other.
Yeah, kids today have it
so easy. Their mom doesn't hang their
sheet out the window.
Their sheet out the window.
But in the interview, Justin, you talked about how you play tons of video games as well.
And look at me.
I mean, it's not...
Do you guys play video games? I mean, is that
for
real?
I do. I play, and I don't play it regularly, but I totally splurged when Miles got a new video game system, which is the Nintendo Switch. I saw that they're finally putting sports games on there, so I got an NBA 2K. 18.
I don't even know what that means.
It's a basketball, NBA basketball. We're going to talk about that coming up in the 9 o'clock hour. But it's
It's a game that is very popular in the gaming community, I found out, because it's one of these games where, and I haven't really made the trans. I just liked it. I even had it when I was in college, and even as a young adult, I had my Nintendo or took wherever apartment I went to, that went with me.
Yeah.
And this is different. This is a game that is almost designed to play with other people. I mean, the games of the Nintendo Switch now are not isolated. Their big selling point is you can get online and play against people and listen to these kind of off-brand hip-hop tracks. Like, that's essentially the whole game. So you got to figure it out as an old man trying to figure out how the joystick,
yeah,
how the joystick works, and deal with it's too loud. And everyone's like, what? Where's that music coming from? Sorry. It's off-brand hip-hop on this video game that they got the license for. So, yes, I do play that game. And I will play a 2013 Madden as well on an old system that I have to plug in and dust off the cords. So there you go. How about you? No, Andre? You know,
what? When you said we're going to talk games, here's how, okay, I hopefully am not showing my age, but I am. I thought you were going to talk about like board games, like Trivial Pursuit.
Yeah, what is your go-to? What's your go-to board game?
Oh, God, I haven't played a board game since probably Apples to Apples or Cards Against Humanity.
Those are great. Yeah. Cards Local. Apples to Apple, that's the more PC version,
you know,
of a Cards Against Humanity.
We did a weekend break story one time on a local, I want to say it was like, not Gamer, maybe it was Gamer's Paradise, but there are so many board games and card games that are made in Chicago.
Yeah.
It's so cool.
It's very cool, and there's a whole cottage industry for
yeah.
it.
Yeah.
Yeah, I feel like, well, I was told this weekend, I want to get you guys' opinion on this before we go to the news, that a good game for an 11-year-old, because my son is getting into chess and those kind of games, would be backgammon.
I've never played that.
Yeah, I don't know anything about it.
Mm-mm.
Really?
Yeah. I'm a chess player. But
it's like a mix between checkers and the game Sorry.
Oh, I love Sorry.
So Sorry, yeah. You know how you have to get all your guys to the space?
Middle?
Yeah, or wherever you got to your colors mm-hmm. home.
Right. Mm-hmm.
It's that concept, but for checkers, that kind of on a cool-looking carrying case board.
Yeah.
That's essentially it.
Oh, that actually sounds fun.
It's fun, and I'm sure there are listeners right now that are, you know, pulling their hair out. Going, what do you mean you don't know back? It's a great game. And there's a lot of strategy to how you move those forward, and I think that if you land on the same spot that competitor's at, they got to go to the back. And so there's a lot going on with that, and it's very interesting. But someone told me that's the game that will resonate or at least attract a 11-year-old.
Yeah, take them down to like the lakefront where they have the all the boards set up.
Yeah, off Fullerton.
With the old timers out there.
Yeah, get him to trash talk. Learn how to trash talk while he does backgammon.
Father like son.
Yeah.
Oh, that's great.
Right. That's right. All right. Coming up in the 9 o'clock hour, we're going to go to a place that you can still pull the board games out and put them on the old table. The Pullman Cafe in the Southside neighborhood of Pullman. Lee Bay, architecture critic and friend, is going to take us to the Pullman Cafe, talk about the issues in that neighborhood as we continue our neighborhood tour. And also, Brandon Scoop B. Robinson will be in studio. We'll talk about the Bulls-Knicks, but also just about, does the NBA need to be successful? And they are very successful. Do they even need the big market teams anymore? We'll find out coming up on Extension 720. It's Extension 720 here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Chicago is called the city that works. And where does it work? Well, in the neighborhoods, of course. Even though the election's been decided, there are still more stories to tell. So tonight we continue our neighborhood convos with Pullman. Pullman, less of a Chicago neighborhood, more of a moment in Chicago history. Pullman is on the south side of Chicago, think 103rd to 115th, bordered east-west by Cottage Grove and the Metro Tracks. It's a throwback, a company town, a whole town built for the Pullman Car Company and their employees. The neighborhood's born of industry, but abandoned by it in the 50s through railroad restructuring and factories moving out. But the neighborhood survived, and in 2015 was designated as a national monument.
Now the area serves as a tourist destination. Politically, it's the Ninth Ward, run by Anthony Beale, who, poetically, was first elected in the 20th century. Demographically, it's that melting pot we hear about all the time. No real majority or minority here. But man, the architecture. Just amazing to be in this area, and as a Chicagoan, selfishly claim it as part of my own. So who better to talk about this neighborhood than my favorite architecture man, Lee Bay. Lee's a longtime architecture critic and photographer. He's got a new book coming out on Southside architecture this fall. He took us to his favorite spot, the Pullman Cafe. It's the perfect location, just a couple blocks south of the famed Pullman Factory and a block from the Pullman Monument. A good cup of coffee on a great day, talking Chicago history. Nothing could be better. So tell me about Pullman. You moved down here not too long ago, but this has been an area that you've known for years.
No, it has. Actually, I moved here 10 years ago. I did sort of two tours of duty here. I was here for 4 or 5 years from like 09 to whatever 5 years from that is. And then went back to Beverly. I owned a house in Beverly, and I was getting divorced at the time. And then when I got rid of the house, came back to Pullman. And it's been great. It's been great.
You know, this is has to be an architecture lover's paradise. When you go up and down, when you go down St. Lawrence here and you see the row houses, it takes you back to, we're not talking like nostalgia of the 50s. We're talking about the early turn of the 20th century. These houses have been, these row houses are unbelievable. There is just a real connection to history here.
You know, there really is. I mean, many of your listeners know, obviously, that this was built as a company town by George Pullman, who made the railroad cars, right? The famous railroad cars that made intercontinental travel possible both here and in Europe, right? And he built these homes for the workers and bosses of his company, which was at 111th and Cottage Grove.
Wow.
A factory there as well. And, you know, the idea was this was architecturally a step up from the kind of shanty, the kind of company town, the kind of shanty town that normally workers would get. Pullman Company owned everything. The workers rented. And it all worked out fine for the first few years until a famous strike happened.
Right.
And ultimately, the company had to divest itself of anything that it didn't own to make, other than what it owned to make railroad cars. So the neighborhood also becomes a real Chicago neighborhood and was excellent over the past century, particularly over the last half of the 20th century and into this century, is that there's been a strong preservationist core here. People who have moved in long time, people who have come in who are already here and have restored these houses, mm-hmm. and really done some great things. It's, you know, on a right day when it's enough snow on the ground or if there's enough fog in the air, it feels like you've gone back to the 1890s.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
It's one of these neighborhoods in Chicago that you're, as someone who's lived here and has spent as little time as possible in Pullman, I'll be honest
mm-hmm.
with you.
Mm-hmm.
When you come through here, you're like, this is like a moment out of time, and it's so distinct. It's hard to think of any other town in America that looks like this, and this is a neighborhood.
It is. It really is.
The southeast side of Chicago, you know, there's a lot of neighborhoods that make that up. What are the issues in Pullman? What are the issues that the residents of this neighborhood specifically have to deal with?
You know, there are a few. You know, as of late, the idea that the neighborhood is I don't want to say regentrifying. It's like one step before that, but clearly there are new faces and new younger faces. I'm not one of those younger faces, but
such a young face.
That's right. Thank you. Coming into the community, and you know the idea is, you know, so where do we go now? What kind of community is this gonna be? And you know, there's also issues of transportation, as you can guess from your ride out here. To do it by car, you come down the Dan Ryan, yep. till you get to the end of that, then the Bishop Ford, till you get to 115th, 111th. But there's a Metro station, Metro tracks right next door to us. But the stations, typical to how Metro treats city customers, you know, the stations need some work.
This is the area that we saw during the winter, during the cold area, where they just shut down the trains. They said, you know what, it's so cold, yeah. you can't go mm-hmm. south, that we're just shutting it down. There are a lot of issues with that Metro Electric and serving the constituents down this way. How much does that play out? I mean, do you feel like Pullman has a voice with City Hall or other places to say, we got to fix this?
You know, I think it does. I mean, one thing, there's a station at 111th, the actual Pullman station, which was a rat hole, to put it in the G rate, to make it G rated. And they fixed it up, I guess, about a year or so ago, a year and a half ago. And it's a simple fix, but they made the waiting area resemble a Pullman car. It's kind of like a wooden version
good.
Of it.
Yeah.
So there is some kind of voice that the neighborhood has here. The other thing is, one of President Obama's last acts was to turn the neighborhood into a national monument. So it kind of puts the Park Service among us. The Park Service doesn't own the houses. We still do. The neighbors still do. But the old factory becomes is on its way to becoming a tourist attraction.
That's interesting, yeah.
And
how has that changed? Because that happened right at the end of his tenure. It's been a couple of years now. Do you notice a change that you now live in a national park or a national monument?
I've noticed more tourists in and about.
Really?
There's still work to do to turn it over to create what's there. I think that when it's work is done, I think there'll be a bump up. I think the one figure the National Park Service said it was something like 300,000 people a year would come here. That's a lot.
I mean, yeah.
That's about as many people about that number comes to the planetarium in a year. That's a fair amount.
That's good. Yeah, right. The demographics of this neighborhood have changed over time, but who lives here?
You know, when I first moved here, I would say it seemed like it was an even, maybe a third or more white, probably a third black and a third Latino. I see, and I guess I'm waiting for the census to bear me out, I see a shrinking of the black population a little bit, but that's happening throughout the South Side, yeah, as we've talked about.
Right.
And I see a little shrinking of the Latino population as well. And I see that the population is a little younger. When I first moved to the place I'm in now, there was an elderly woman next to me. She sold to a couple probably in their late 30s, early 40s. And I'm seeing a white couple, and I'm beginning to see more and more of that.
This has been an area that has, for a while now, I'd say for the last decade, been rife with rumors about development. And whether that be the old steel plants or City Works,
a bit away from here, but within the same region.
But this area has all been, all the old factories and manufacturing here about change. Is that happening in Pullman? Do you feel like there's more and more development coming this way?
You know, there really is. I mean, one of the success stories to me, by my eye at least, over the past few years, has been the ongoing redevelopment of 111th Street just west of the expressway. This is where factories went to die and stayed there and died, right? and groups like Chicago Neighborhood Initiatives, which is located here in the neighborhood that David Doig runs and others he's beginning to bring into the mix, they've brought some development on 111th Street. So you see, I think, a Potbellies and a Cleaners, and these kind of simple but early insertions of retail there, which has been fantastic. Mm. The big thing has been the Walmart and the mall that's around the Walmart, fashioned around the Walmart, that was on the old Ryerson Steel site, which is right next to the Bishop Ford Expressway, just before you get to 111th. Those have been two big things that have happened over the past couple of years. You know, without some controversy, you know, many people in the neighborhood are like, Walmart, that kind of thing. And I appreciate that. But it's something. But it's slowly beginning to happen, which is good.
We've been doing these conversations really about the runoff election, and now that election is over, and we have a new mayor and a new city council. As someone who lives in Pullman, do you feel like you're going to have a voice in city council, or is it just going to be fighting in city council about who's in city council?
You know, I hope so. I mean, Anthony Beal, the alderman here, actually has been a strong voice for Pullman, although his ward encompasses a bunch of other communities. I think both mayoral candidates through Chicago Neighborhood Initiatives came out to Pullman in the last weeks of the campaign, both Preckwinkle and Mayor-elect Lightfoot before the election. So, you know, I think we'll get our attention. I think the larger question is, you know, there's Roseland next to us. Mm-hmm. Can, you know, whatever comes out of City Hall and whatever is hatched, can it be a solution for both communities? I think to pay attention to one and allow one to get the spoils at the benefit of the other. I was encouraged by Rahm coming out to Pullman and embracing Pullman, right? I didn't see much of him in Roseland, which is right next door to us. And really is our neighbor. And I think there really has to be a two-community solution to what happened.
That seems to be a thread when we have these conversations about the relationship, or at least the symmetry, or the back and forth dance between neighboring neighborhoods, if that makes sense. This idea that there is this one, you really can't be isolated if you're Pullman. You can't have all the issues that are happening in this area can't be one neighborhood or another. So how do you deal with that when there is a lot of, and I don't say rivalries, but there's a lot of pride to be where you're from and not from the neighborhood that's next to you?
You know, there really is. I mean, that's one of the things about this being a consistently Balkanized city, right? You know, every tribe, you know, had their piece, and usually separated from the other tribe by a railroad track or a viaduct. And, you know, that's not how a 21st century city has to be governed. We got to bring those things down. You know, one big barrier between us and Pullman, between Pullman and Roseland, is the Metro track, which is a raised embankment that, you know, runs and splits the communities.
Right.
What can be done in those stations, underneath those embankments, underneath those viaducts, I should say, to bring the two communities together? You see art making the insertion, right? Making that insertion. I mean, murals that start underneath one side of the viaduct and kind of run underneath, they kind of pull you in.
Right.
But that's what it really takes. I mean, the city, Metra, to pick on them again, really saying this is a barrier. How do we turn it from a wall to a handshake, if you will?
Back to let's kind of end here, but just this idea of the architecture down here. Mm-hmm. And, you know, for you, I know that this, you've lived your life through Chicago architecture. You got a book coming out and mm-hmm. about Southside architecture. But it really, to everyone else in Chicago, surrounding suburbs, people listening right now, there's nothing else like this. I mean, it's really hard to find this kind of architecture still intact several years later.
There really is. I mean, there's small things here and there. There's Curly Court on the north side where you see this kind of gaslight era architecture, but it's like a block or half a block,
right,
or two-thirds
right.
of a block. But to see essentially a town of almost 2,000 is unique. You know, we're right across the street right now. We're in the Pullman Cafe, so right across the street from Greenstone Church. Magnificent church made of green limestone. Needs some work, and there's some efforts there, preservation efforts there to help it along. But you'll go all 200 square miles of this city. You'll never see a church remotely like this 18th century beauty, or the court that's next to us at 112th and Champlain, where the grid stops, and there are four curved apartment buildings with a colonnade, sidewalk level colonnade that you walk through. Just incredible stuff. Really incredible stuff. And, you know, and much props to the people who have been here and have come in here, who appreciate this architecture and have kept it up.
Do you see yourself, maybe you can become the Pullman docent? You can be the guy who walks around block to block. You can take advantage of it being a national monument, huh?
There are people here who are far more qualified than that, who I'm glad they're not in this restaurant. They'd be over my shoulder right now. But that's one of the beautiful things about it. The people here love the history. They're all experts on the history. And the National Park Service actually has a ranger with a Smokey Bear hat and everything that is in charge of that kind of stuff. So, not me. Not me.
Thanks, Lee.
Thank you.
Lee Bay, architecture critic, former city planner, as well as an author. He's got a book coming out on Southside architecture. Worked with him for years. He lives in Pullman. Took us to the Pullman Cafe. Tomorrow, you'll hear from Garfield Park, East Garfield Park, with former mayoral candidate Amara Enya. We have that and more as we continue. We've decided to continue our neighborhood tours past the election and try to get all 77 and beyond. If you have recommendations about towns, cities, municipalities, we'll just keep doing this, right? Right. Breaking news tonight, Magic Johnson stepping down as the president of basketball operations for the Los Angeles Lakers. That's a big deal. He was the man who brought LeBron James to Los Angeles. He had a master plan, drafted Lonzo Ball. The Lakers have been as, if not more, disappointing than the Bulls because there were expectations attached to the Lakers. And we are in a perfect position. This is great to have coming in studio, Scoop B, Brandon Robinson, who covers the Knicks and basketball for MSG Network. He's in town because the Knicks are in town. And how great to have a national sports writer coming in. I want to talk to him about the health of the league, but also just about whether or not the NBA even needs these big market teams anymore to compete. But he walks right in to talk about the Magic Johnson legacy at the Lakers as he is out as basketball president of basketball operations. He may still stay with the team. I'm not sure that wasn't specified, but he was running the shop there, and he's not anymore. So that will be coming up here in the 9:30 news. 312-981-7200. If you have a recommendation, I just kind of casually threw that out about a neighborhood tour. A lot of people text in saying, hey, yeah, we love the neighborhood tour. We'd like, come here, you know. I want to hit all 77. There are 77 communities identified by the City of Chicago map. I don't know who does that map. Not realtors. The realtor map, there would be 6,000. East downtown River Westway. But there are 77 communities. So we've probably hit, what, 7, 8, something like that, in the since we started the Extension 720 reboot. So we have many more to get to, and I'm excited. I'm trying to make this. I realize that it's somewhat biased because I'm only talking to one person. I'm not doing big pieces on these neighborhoods. These are friends of mine. These are people I've worked with and people I've known. They've lived in these communities, and they can tell me firsthand their experiences. It's not a neighborhood tour that I talk to the mayor or the alderman or the person who does a majority of business there. I'd like to have some connection with them, but just getting the word out saying Arlington Heights. I'm like, oh, who do I know in Arlington Heights? And then I start thinking about it. I'm like, Jerome lives in Arlington Heights, right?
the way to do it.
That's the way to do it. So give us, inspire us,
312-981-7200. Extension 720
here on 720 WGN. The Bulls play their final game at the United Center tonight for the 2018-2019 season. They lost to the Knicks. At least the Bulls were consistent down to the end. The Knicks and the Bulls are both in rebuilding mode. The Knicks are going to have the best chance in the lottery to land the number one pick and Duke superstar Zion Williamson. But this isn't the first time either of these squads have had lottery picks, yet the losing has continued. But the NBA keeps growing without these big market teams. Bulls, Knicks, and now the Lakers. Speaking of the Lakers, breaking news, as we just mentioned, Magic Johnson reportedly stepping down as president of basketball operations. Has the NBA moved on from needing these big market teams to compete? Brandon Scoopy Robinson, senior writer for Basketball Society and a writer for Heavy Magazine, also the podcast Scoopy Radio. Great to have you. And I, like I said, pretty lucky to have you in studio tonight.
I'm glad to be here.
Amazing. I mean, you're at the game tonight. I want to talk about that.
Yes.
But there was so much made about the return of Magic Johnson, for him taking over the team, that he was what the Lakers needed. He obviously was instrumental in getting LeBron James to L.A. This season has been a train wreck. I mentioned right before the break that the expectations, in a way, even more disappointing than a Bulls season, because we knew they were going to be in a rebuild. There were expectations on this squad, this Lakers squad, that they might, you know, compete for a title with LeBron James, but they didn't come anywhere near that.
Yeah, and I'll add that the line of demarcation for the Lakers this season this year was LeBron James's groin injury on Christmas Day and the persistent trade rumors surrounding Chicago's own Anthony Davis potentially leaving the Pelicans and going to the Los Angeles Lakers. That was not fruitful. You have a team where there was rumors that Lonzo Ball and Brandon Ingram and Kyle Kuzma and the kitchen sink and their cousin baby mama's best friend were all going to the New Orleans Pelicans. I've been running all day. So I think at the end of the day, when you really look at what the proof is in the pudding, it stinks.
You know, it is interesting when you think about Magic Johnson and his tenure, because you mentioned right before the break, just his relationship with the coach was fractured all year.
Sure.
You had to feel that he was going to fire him. You're right. You rarely see the debacle that happened with the Pelicans trade play out like that publicly, when it all came out, it almost felt like the Pelicans were dogging the Lakers, like they were playing with them in some way. It didn't seem very professional by any stretch.
Well, you also have to take into account that the Pelicans are owned by the Benson family, who also own the New Orleans Saints. And they play seconds from each other in downtown New Orleans. Dell Demps was fired. Dell Demps was the general manager of the New Orleans Pelicans, was fired actually during NBA All-Star Weekend. Dell Demps played in the NBA, spoke to some of Demps' closest friends, and they were just ticked off that they let him go, particularly during All-Star Weekend. They said some four-letter words. We were on live radio. But what I will say is that Demps and the Lakers, I've heard different versions of the story. The deal was done. There were different variations of that deal, and basically Demps did not have the last word. Some organizations, general managers or team presidents, they can sign off on certain things. Demps had a shorter leash. And what I'll tell you is, and just talking to former members of the Pelicans organization, there was no surprise that he was gone. And it was kind of a situation where LeBron James, Rich Paul, Clutch Sports, Magic Johnson, and all parties involved tried to make something happen that didn't exist, wouldn't exist, and I don't know, the jury's still out if it can exist, because now you're going to the offseason.
You know, does a high profile end of a tenure with Magic Johnson and Lakers, has it put pressure on some other tenuous situations in the NBA, notably in Chicago, but the idea that other programs that aren't working or teams that aren't doing well, does it put more of a spotlight on the fact that they're not succeeding?
Well, you know, it's interesting you say that, because I spoke to our buddy Lawrence Holmes earlier today, and I said to him that the Bulls can't sell players on nostalgia and Michael Jordan, just like the Lakers can't sell folks on multiple championships. I think that it's based off the product that's on the floor, and I think that history shows within the last 10 years of the NBA, you don't have to be in a major market to win a championship. LeBron won a championship in Cleveland. Mm-hmm. He's from Northeast Ohio. Gone have been the days of where you had to go to Madison Avenue. You can bring Madison Avenue to you.
Right.
And so I think that's the difference. Look at the Milwaukee Bucks with Giannis Antetokounmpo this season.
Right.
They could potentially go to the finals.
And you're starting to see him in commercial after commercial. You're right. He does not need to live in L.A. Then why did LeBron James go to L.A.? I mean, I was sold on the idea he wanted to be close to Hollywood.
What do the Lakers and the Celtics have in common? They produce stars. Mm-hmm. LeBron James is the face of the NBA. Some argue with Steph Curry. LeBron is the modern day Michael Jordan for the league. I'm not comparing him to Michael Jordan. We're not arguing tonight. But what I will say to you is, I think there was a duality. LeBron recognized when he came to the NBA that he was a brand. He lives like a brand. He ties his shoes like a brand. He chews his gum like a brand. Oh, and yeah, by the way, Space Jam 2 will be taped this summer.
It's easier for him.
A lot of tax credits being divvied out as well this summer.
You know, the story in Chicago that's been given to the fans, and as this season wraps up, and it's the second or third now. There, you know, I don't want to get there. Was they had the one playoff run with Jimmy Butler and Dwayne Wade, mm-hmm. But the story is that the Chicago Bulls are a successful entity in the NBA.
They have
a branding. They have seats are filled. If you go to the United Center, I went and watched a game this year. It was packed. So, is there an incentive for this team to make drastic changes, to excite the fan base? Or is it plot the course and hope the course is right?
You know, it's funny. I'm a child of the 90s. I grew up watching the Bulls and the Michael Jordan in the 90s, Scotty Rodman, and what have you. I'm a brand ambassador for Zenni Optical. Zenni, they want me to say Zenni. They flew me out here. I think that a lot of times with Zenni, I think that they mentioned in their introductory press conference about their move that this is an iconic franchise. Because I'm a child of the 90s, I have to now think like my parents. When they were looking at the Lakers and the Celtics and the Yankees and the Dodgers and all those mm-hmm. teams, yeah, they are. I had to scratch my eyes and be like, well, yeah, they kind of are. We're at that point now where we look at them like that. But it's a brand new day in this instance. Most kids who are in the NBA now remember Michael Jordan as a Washington Wizard, not as a Chicago Bull.
Don't say that.
No, but and I mean no disrespect know, to your I know, city, I know. But most of these kids are born in the 90s now, right, or late 80s. So I think that when you have big market cities like the Bulls, the Knicks, the Lakers, the Celtics, you have to recruit and woo as if what the talent is on the floor, not the location.
For you, from your perch as a national basketball writer, what is the thought on the Chicago Bulls? Well, locally, we get caught up in everything, and there's so much push and pull on that organization. But are there any, when you look at the rebuilding teams, you say, oh, they're doing it the right way, or they're exciting, they're going to be great in a year. Is there any talk about the Bulls?
I think that quietly you hear certain things like, okay, if the Lakers and the Celtics, for example, don't get Anthony Davis, what team could get him? I can tell you that the Denver Nuggets reached out to the Pelicans and asked them, you know, to potentially commence a trade at the trade deadline. They declined. I think that it would be a great homecoming with the Derrick Rose documentary coming out, et cetera, et cetera. Right. I have no intel on this.
Right.
But I do think that it would be great for the league. It would be great for Chicago if somehow the Chicago Bulls made an interesting step or a mea culpa to bring not only Anthony Davis in the fold via trade, but to also bring Derrick Rose home.
There's a lot of talk about Derrick Rose, and I think that there is a soft spot in Chicago's heart. I know that you know, it didn't work out the way we wanted to, but no one has seen anything like that. I mean, Michael Jordan and Scottie Pippen, they are obviously icons, but what Derrick Rose brought to this city, it was we'd never seen a meteoric rise like that, and fall, to be honest.
Yeah, and I think that in Chicago, well, for Derrick Rose in particular, spoke to Kevin Garnett, Farragut Academy alum, said to me, asked me at the before the season started, asked him about Derrick Rose. He said, would you start him? He asked me, would I start him? And I said, yeah. I said, would you? He goes, hell yeah. And people laughed. Derrick Rose had everything to prove on a veteran's minimum contract and proved himself in the playoffs last year. And I also think, I'll tell you this. I went to school in Philadelphia and was in school during the time that Allen Iverson was roaming the earth. I even remembered Allen Iverson as a child reporter. I began at 12 years old. Being in Chicago and living in Philadelphia, Derrick Rose is you guys' Allen Iverson. Y'all love him. And Allen Iverson is not even from Philly. He's from Hampton, Virginia. there is a love that you guys have that I've not seen for a player. I think some people love Derrick Rose more than sometimes they love Michael Jordan because he's homegrown.
Yeah, there is something about, and they did a great job marketing him. They really did at the time he was when he was a star, even in his rehab.
Sure,
there was a commercial here where after he busted his knee for the first time, and we were waiting for him to return.
Sure,
the stories in the newspaper were every other day saying, "Oh, you know what? I heard he's coming back earlier." Oh, they put out this commercial where the whole city stopped because they heard like a clanking. And it turned to him lifting weights.
Yeah.
There's not an athlete I can think of. I don't even know if that would be the case with a Chicago Bear or a they wouldn't talk about the return from an injury in a commercial.
When I was at the Source magazine some years ago, I wrote a full feature on ACL injuries. I actually tore my ACL back in 2011 and had surgery and sat out for a while. That's not an easy injury to come back from. And the other thing is he has the pressure of being the hometown guy. Everybody can't play home. I don't know how he did it. He's Houdini in my book. And for him to come back and just seeing his interviews, he's even the way he's marketing himself now or is branded, he's a family guy now. I think that, you know, early in his career, hometown guy, young, having fun,
yeah.
Whatever he does in his personal business is his personal business, you can assume. But what I'm going to say is there's a difference between a 20-something and a 30-something. And I don't think he has to be all-star Derrick Rose to be effective. I don't think it's just for nostalgia's sake. I think he can help, though.
You know, as you talk about playing home, does Derrick Rose run, if he does, determine if the Bulls and Derrick Rose say, let's have a reunion? Is that that's a lot of extra pressure because of what happened before, and how do you think Chicago fans, basketball fans, react?
Well, let me just say this, because I get in trouble on Twitter and just social media. I have no intel on Derrick Rose coming. We're talking in supposeds and hypotheticals.
Yeah, that's talk radio.
But this is what I'll say. I think that, number one, Derrick Rose is due one more big payday. Do the Bulls want to invest in Derrick Rose in that regard? That's firstly. But before we go to firstly, we'll go to number zero. They need a new coach.
Yeah. Well, they have a coach that is under contract, and they extended him in a strange way where when he was brought in, they didn't give him an interim tag. They said, yeah, I think he's on contract till the end of next year. And a lot of sports writers and basketball fans head scratched on that.
Yeah.
It was about stability.
Sure. And I think that when you look at that locker room, I know there was an issue with Hoiberg and the team earlier in the season, just a lot of dysfunction. I don't know the inner workings of their locker room because I haven't really, really paid attention to the Bulls a ton. Mm-hmm. But what I will say is, a lot of good assistants become good head coaches. Look at Tyronn Lue in Cleveland. Meaning there were players in that Bulls locker room that probably he listened to, and so he got that job. Mm-hmm. Pete Myers is still there. I like Pete Myers. I think he's a mainstay. But I do think that the coach that's there and the players that are there, you want to build around Zach LaVine. And then that goes into, you know, what they do in the offseason. Where will they land in the draft? I was at the game earlier, and I saw, you know, the Knicks and the Bulls were playing. The lottery selection will be like a month from now. I saw a fan with a Knicks number one jersey that said, not Zion. And the other one said, Bulls number one, Zion. It's on my Twitter. Follow me on Twitter at Scoop B. You'll see it there. I do think that the Bulls need to figure out whether they want to get a slashy guard. I personally think that if they fall below number three and they get R.J. Barrett at four, they go for it.
Oh, yeah, I agree. I'm wholeheartedly. He looks like he's an NBA player already when you see him in the tournament.
And you know who his godfather is? Steve Nash.
Oh.
Yeah.
There you go. Learning stuff tonight at Extension 720. Brandon Scoop B. Robinson is here. He's a senior writer for Basketball Society, also a writer for Heavy.com. This is podcast Scoop B Radio. We'll take a quick break, come back, and more with Brandon Robinson talking about the NBA here on Extension 720. Stay with us.
Loud like church folk, heavy like workload. How you like Merkos, never saying Kirk F. Bang like Kirko, ankle like Kirk, came back like dirt. Rose, she always get in her own way. When I try, she always.
Extension 720, we're talking basketball tonight. Very happy to have Brandon Scoop B. Robinson in studio, senior writer for Basketball Society, also a writer for Heavy.com. His podcast, Scoop B Radio, can be found everywhere.
3.5 million streams last year.
Congratulations.
Thank you, sir.
And, you know, it's kind of, it's so competitive to be a reporter in the NBA. And you see more and more that people are flocking to social media to get their news. And this is even more than I think football, even baseball. The NBA is very competitive. So you have to develop relationships with teams and players and assistants and coaches. How do you do that? How do you make sure that you're at the top of your game?
Parties. You go to parties, you exchange numbers. I was at the Jordan party during All-Star weekend. I was at Dwayne Wade Spade's party during All-Star weekend. And the other advantage I think I have is I started in the business young. And I also went to a prep school. I went to prep school with Corey Wooten, who played for the Chicago Bears.
Right.
And I'm 6'5". I'm tall. I speak their language. And I think at the end of the day, it's really about who's real and who's genuine. And I try to be genuine.
Corey Wooten has one of the best trivia stats in Chicago Bears history. He was the guy who got the sack on Brett Favre Brett Favre's career.
Yes, he was.
I think he might have separated his shoulder, but I just remember that was
something
that he hates, because every Bears fan loves that. But
yes, but I mean, he's doing TV now, and
exactly,
I'm happy
for him. You know, the NBA is an international brand, and it seems to be. You see, baseball obviously is international as well, and they've spent a lot of time in Latin American countries and also in Asia.
Mm-hmm.
But you're seeing more and more the NBA is attracting European players that are more sophisticated and more NBA ready than some of the kids that are doing 1 year at Duke.
Surely.
And you're seeing this over and over and over. Is this the future for the NBA? Is this an international game?
It's the now and the next, and I think the catalyst for it was the 1992 Dream Team. I'll never forget Charles Barkley. They asked him in a presser, what do you think about Angola? And he said, I don't know nothing about Angola, but I know Angola's in trouble. I think that the Dream Team, I mean, you had guys like Tony Parker, Dirk Nowitzki, and others breaking their necks to stay up late to watch those guys play. Michael Jordan was the catalyst for brands, branding, and the global game that is basketball. He took the baton from Magic, Bird, and Isaiah Thomas, and here we are.
The interesting today is, as we talked about the end of Magic Johnson's tenure at the Lakers, he was stepping down as president of basketball operations. We talked about LeBron James a little bit. One guy we haven't talked about, and we really talk about the end of an era, is Dwayne Wade. He played here in Chicago, grew up here in Chicago and Robbins. He is finishing his career, and he has been on a year-long tour where they're just not unlike Kareem back in the day when it was his last game, where they're just giving him boats and different prizes. Everywhere
sure.
he went, I was at the game where they played the Miami Heat at the United Center, and we had to stop the game three times for Dwayne mm-hmm. Wade celebrations.
Mm-hmm.
But this tonight was his last game in Miami. His mark, this kid's mark, and I say kid, he's
a grown
38.
Man.
He's a grown man. But his mark
sure.
on basketball.
He reinvented himself, and he sought wise counsel. He won his first championship in 06 with Shaq when he was traded from the Lakers. Shaq taught him about branding and ambassadorship, and he took that and ran with it. And then he teamed with two other guys, and Chris Bosh and LeBron James and Ray Allen, and won two more championships. And I think that he also has a at least visually a good the optics with the marriage with Gabrielle Union, who knows how to construct a brand as well. So
mm-hmm.
I think for him, I'm excited for what happens after the NBA. And most people don't get a retirement tour. Shaq didn't get one. And I think more than anything, I think he's a genuine guy. I actually talked to Dwayne a couple months ago, and I said, hey, man, you're supposed to appreciate your legends while they're living. I said this to Chris Tucker as well. I said, thank you for being the fabric of my life during midterms in college, grad school, when I was looking for jobs and, you know, freelancing here and there. You were the soundtrack while I was grinding,
what
and you were
say?
Grinding.
Do you recognize that?
Yeah.
I mean, I think that that's a tremendous thing to say to somebody, and you wonder about some of these players, and Dwayne Wade comes to mind.
I attributed it on my Instagram today, early this morning, and I said, you know, like, you don't find players like that. Like, Michael didn't have a retirement tour. Like, you kind of guessed he was going to retire in 98
right,
from
right,
the Bulls, and,
right.
you know, that's the end. I'm happy for him.
Yeah. And it just comes down to, you know, we seem to be at a point where there seems to be a new guard. Obviously, we're seeing a tremendous play from the Golden State Warriors at such a high level. But there are younger players who are coming in, younger and younger each time. You know, the kids that are coming out of Duke, like you mentioned, Zion and R.J. Barrett are going to be, what, 19 years old
mm-hmm.
When they come out. It is time for a new passing of the baton, if you will.
And, sure.
And so what do you see for next year's NBA, the year, 5 years from now, 10 years? Is it going to be a different kind of league than we know now?
The return of the big man. You saw in the NCAA tournament guys like Taco Fall in the post. And you're seeing in the NBA more so these hybrid big men like, somebody like Jahlil Okafor was a good example, Chicago's own.
Whitney Young.
Certain things happened in the NBA with assist time with the Sixers that changed his trajectory. But Julius Randle, a member of the New Orleans Pelicans, he had a decent season quietly this season. And I think that you're going to see more hybrid big men and traditional big men, because in the NBA in the 90s, the golden era of the NBA, you had David Robinson, Hakeem Olajuwon, Shaq. Even Robert Parrish won a ring sitting on the bench with the Bulls, the Chief.
He did.
You know, at the end of the day, I think you're going to see a return of a big man. And, you know, LeBron and Jamal Crawford and Vince Carter are currently now the OGs as Dwayne Wade passes that baton on. But their time will come soon, too.
You know, just as we look at that and we wrap this up, how are the players? Are they happy? I mean, there's so much being talked about in other sports like Major League Baseball, even football to an extent, but about work stoppages or possibly lockouts or changing the way free agency does. This will bubble up a lot with NBA players, and it seems more often than not that they're unhappy with the situation. Are players happy right now?
I'll say their WNBA counterparts are not, and I think that that needs to change, and I think that they should strike. And I've spoken to some WNBA players that don't get equal wages. They got to share rooms at hotels and sometimes fly commercial, and I don't think that's fair. During their off seasons, they got to play overseas. It's not fair, and I think things should be done. It shouldn't be just women's rights because it's a fad.
Right.
It should be equal pay because they bust their butts just as hard as their male counterparts. Yeah. As far as the NBA is concerned, they're doing wonderful right now.
Yeah, everyone's making money.
The mental health part is the part that I'm concerned about.
Yeah, how do you mean?
Pressure. You got people banging on your door, coming out the woodwork left and right because you are who you are. And, you know, you got to be careful. You can't trust everybody, and you can't take business advice from sometimes even your mother, your father, your cousin.
We've seen that play out in certain athletes. Does the NBA recognize that? Do the teams of the Bulls hire people to protect their young stars?
I mean, there's security. Every team has a guy that watches the team, and you know, when they go to All-Star Weekend, for example, they hire out local law enforcement, but they have security, but, you know, they can get at you on social media. There's a lot of just accessibility.
Yeah, that's a conversation to continue. Brandon Scoop B. Robinson, a senior writer for Basketball Society, also a writer for Heavy.com. His podcast, Scoop B. Radio, can be found everywhere. Brandon, pleasure to meet you. Thanks for coming in studio and talking NBA with us on Extension 720.
An honor.